The government has clearly lost control of the economy.
We are looking at a Conservative majority of 86.
Why is the Prime Minister making a bad situation worse for working people by hammering them with a cut to universal credit and a tax rise?
Will you shut up, please?
Order! Order!
From 2 till 4, every single Wednesday, bringing you the news without the spin, the stories behind the headlines, through interviews, discussion, and more. Politics Unboxed on Expression FM.
Hello, and welcome to the Politics Unboxed podcast. My name is Rhys, and today you're going to be listening to a very special episode of PU The Interview. And, well, I would have explained more about it earlier, but it came about at quite short notice, but very, very welcome surprise. This is an interview with the representative, or prospective representative, i.e. candidate, for Congress in Ohio's 7th Congressional District, Matthew Deemer. First off, thank you very much, Matthew, for agreeing to come on to the podcast for this. I know there's a lot of time, or rather not a lot of time left before your big election day, with it being tomorrow. I want to ask, how have you been feeling? How's your campaign been going so far?
Campaign's been going good, you know, so we're feeling good. We're going to tomorrow. There is, you know, a lot of energy out there in the U.S. on a lot of different issues. So we're just, you know, plugging along and can't wait to see how everything closes out at the end of day tomorrow.
Feeling confident?
Feeling confident. But again, you know, just have a lot of work to do between today and tomorrow, and make sure that we're getting out there, shaking as many hands as possible, and getting out those votes.
Absolutely. Obviously, with this being the first midterm election under Joe Biden, it's a big day for the Democrats tomorrow. There's a lot on the line. I want to start with some sort of broad brush questions and then get into the real specifics of your campaign for Ohio's 7th.
Yeah, sure.
With the Democrats currently holding that trifecta of both houses of Congress and the presidency, it looks like your party are heading into this election with sort of everything to lose. How's it been feeling on the ground with Democrats? So is there a general feel of, yes, we can do this, we can hold these seats that we need to and press forward? Or is it a bit more of, crikey, the Republicans are coming?
You know, that's funny the way you say it, you phrase it. Look, I think that nobody understands what's going to happen in this midterm election. So there's been a lot of polling, a lot of ideas of what's important to voters this time, and what is going to be on top of people's minds when they go into that voting box. But I honestly don't think that any one party or one person or one campaign knows how that's going to weigh or tip the scales. And so I think that when we're talking about Republicans and Democrats, traditionally, obviously, as you know, since you're asking the question, the party that's in power with the presidency usually loses some sort of ground in Congress in a midterm election. With that said, we don't know how that's going to turn out or if it will actually come to fruition like everybody expects it to happen. I will say, though, there's some key races that obviously both parties are keeping an eye on that I think will set the tone for a few election cycles to come if they go a different way than everybody's expecting. For example, the Warnock-Walker race in Georgia. If Herschel Walker beats Raphael Warnock, that is a horrible sign. There's also the Tim Ryan, J.D. Vance race here. If Tim Ryan, in the race that he's been running with his messaging and running, I think, one of the best Senate campaigns in recent history, if he cannot pull that off against J.D. Vance, that's going to set a very bad tone for the Democrats going forward. And then, you know, we're looking at, you know, the Blake Masters, Kelly race over in Arizona, plus, you know, a couple other ones, the Fetterman Oz, obviously, which has got more complex since Oz had his medical incident. And so, like, we're looking at those races to set the national tone. And then if you want to just, you know, break it down to Congress as well, there's other things that are going to set the national tone. So just to summarize, I think that nobody knows what's going to happen. I think that there's a lot of stuff at play that could tip the scales in surprises and all kinds of ways. But, you know, honestly, a lot of people are just right now with their heads down trying to put the work in.
Definitely a sense of there's a lot of work coming in on both sides, or potentially you could even say on three sides, because you have Liz Cheney occupying this weird middle ground between the Republican Party of old and the Democratic Party of now. But I wanted to
move on slightly. Obviously, this is the first election since the, well, some would call it the steal. Others would call it the free, fair election of 2020. I think we know where the side of the facts are on that particular debate. That has been quite a big issue. You're running against Max Miller in Ohio's 7th, who has somewhat of a link to various elements of election disapproval, which is something of a worry. But there seems to be a rise of candidates who would seek to either overturn or call the election invalid in both the House, Senate, and at many different levels up and down the ballot. So I wonder, how important do you feel this race is, given that we're seeing the rise of Lauren Boebert in and Marjorie Taylor Greene still continuing her rise in Congress at the moment?
Well, oh, first I want to just correct a word that you said. You said election disapproval. No, they're election deniers. And so when you don't have, and you're making claims about the faith of our election system and still trying to run races in our election system, and then if you lose, you say that it was a rigged election, I don't know what the hell you're doing even running a race. And I don't know why you're being a participant in our democracy. So my opponent is full on a denier. It says that his previous boss won the election and that it was stolen from them. There's a congressperson in Texas, Dan Crenshaw, who is Republican. He's part of this whole, like, I want to call it WWE hype politician sort of, you know, marketing that is out there. And he came out just the other day and said, look, everybody on the back end behind closed doors knows this was a lie, knows that they're making this up for, you know, headline purposes. And if he's a Republican coming out to say that, saying that this is just something that a narrative that they're running with, we have serious issues on what kind of narratives that are being allowed to be run with and what we're tolerating as a democracy. So we have to win. When you ask the rise of Lauren Boebert or whatever, look, they're made up characters that are promoting a narrative that does not fit with anything that is going to be good policy for the country. And so this election, honestly, hopefully is a referendum on, do we trust the electoral process and our democracy here in the US, or do we not? And the last thing I want to comment on that is, look, I know many people across the aisles, from the left, the right, the Trump, the Trump supporters to not Trump supporters, right? And anybody who has ever worked the polls or worked in the elections have come out saying that they trust this system. They trust this system. They go in there skeptical, but they come out going, yeah, no, these are fair elections, and this process is pretty sound. And so if anybody still believes that, I volunteer, be part of the process, go sign up to be a poll worker or go sign up to do something else and see how this process works. And I think that you'll come out with more enlightened.
Certainly, it seems to be, certainly on the Democratic side, there is a major push here to make sure that this is the referendum on trust and integrity in both the electoral system and, you can say, in certain areas of political policy. But I want to turn to your individual campaign for Ohio 7th now. Your campaign on your website says it's all about putting policy over politics. Now, I think you may be able to anticipate the question I'm about to ask. Sounds like a political slogan rather than a policy. What does that look like in practice, putting policy over politics?
Well, it's definitely a political slogan. That's why it's nice three words and it rolls off the tongue. but in practice, and then, you know, when I'm out there talking to people, what does that mean? Look, you're over there in the UK, and I think that the United States was founded not on the two-party system that we have, but it was founded on a representative system that people were supposed to represent the areas and the places that they come from and work with other people. So, for example, in Parliament, you guys have, you know, political parties, and they're not. And if somebody doesn't have the majority of everything, they have to work with the other parties to get things done, to get policies, you know, pushed through. And so when the founders of the United States and our Constitution, they never thought that a representative from New York would think the same way as a representative from Virginia, even if they're both Democrat, or a representative from Virginia is the same way as Ohio, or Ohio and Los Angeles, right? And so it was envisioned that these representatives of these districts in these specific culturally, geographically unique areas would have to work with one another, but still push and promote their local and regional issues with their, you know, coming from their constituents. And so to put policy over politics means that we have to get on the ground here in Ohio 7th, to try to talk to the people within Ohio 7th to make policy that represents and reflects Ohio 7th. And that does not mean reflecting the politics of a Democrat from New York City or a Democrat from Hollywood. It says, what is a Democrat and what does a policy look like on a vote in Washington that represents the people of Ohio 7th? And to do that, we have to talk to people. We have to get on the ground. We have to bring people together from both sides of the aisle, from the different demographics that we have, the different geographies, the different industries, take that to Washington and advocate for our district in Washington when it comes to bills as well in policy. So that's what policy over politics is.
So probably the founding fathers would probably say, what in the world's Los Angeles if you ask them how the Democrats would vote from there? But certainly that is something that I think your party's, well, certainly nominal leader at the moment, Joe Biden, is suggesting is something he was trying to move towards in 2020, this sort of purpleization of American politics over being necessarily Democrat or Republican, but American and putting the interests first. But now with these very strict sort of messaging things that are coming out from sometimes at the very top, we see Nancy Pelosi trying to enforce her ways of pushing forward legislation through her role as House Speaker. We see Joe Biden now trying to indicate where he would like the Democratic Party to move. Is there a danger that by pushing for this perhaps what you would see as greater toleration and acceptance across the political aisle, that you lose what it is to be defined as a Democrat? Or is that something that people would just not see from your campaign?
Look, coming from over here from Ohio, I think that we don't want to be defined as anything. And I think that's one of the problems with these two-party systems, is that you have great candidates on both sides that are looking at these specific regions, areas, as I said, and that's why I put Virginia as one of the first examples in New York, not Los Angeles, by the way. The dates are important. But are looking at the regions and saying, look, it really sucks that you have this person who's been born and raised in a certain area, trying to represent a certain constituency that they grew up as, and you get labeled with a brand by these people who are from Nancy Pelosi from California, is creating this whole Democratic narrative that doesn't represent Ohio. Look, Ohioans, for example, are not that. We don't want to be branded. We have so many unaffiliated that are voting right now. For example, I think 1/3 of the people that have voted, early voted, are unaffiliated. They're not a D or an R. They're people who says, I'm going to try to vote for the best guy. I'm going to, you know, see what I feel in this election, or I don't want to be classified, you know, for the most part. And I get that more and more. I'm independent. And that's because you don't want to be branded with a color, red, blue, a letter, DR, and so on and so forth, and fit into every other ideology. So in all fairness, there is an old guard of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. There is the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's and the Mitch McConnell's that all have to go retire somewhere and let this new generation come over with what we think is of how America should be represented. And yeah, look, I can't stress that enough. You know, 40 plus years in Washington is too long, and these old guard, 80 years old or so, it doesn't represent anymore. So that's why there's a lot of people either becoming either unaffiliated, you know, pushing for a different kind of talking points or politics, or trying to represent a different way outside of these, I guess, boxes that we're put into.
So I guess that's sort of a tacit thank you for your service, Ms. Pelosi, but maybe it's time to think about handing the baton, I guess, from what you're saying.
I think there's a lot of people that are in there to say thank you for your service, but it's time to. And I think that's why a lot more Americans are saying, let's go with term limits. Obviously, campaign finance reform is a big issue, too. There's a lot of things that just allows entrenched power to create dictations of the political ideology from that is not representative of the different places in America. So, yeah, thank you for your service. But it's time for both. The McConnell and the Schumers and the Pelosi's, and it's time to move on.
I think we will move on from the national issues to some of your specific issues that you've raised on your campaign website, which I've had a good look through and trying to find out how best to ask you these questions. My first question was going to be, is one of your statements a veiled swing at the Democratic leadership for being too hegemonic? But there we go. You've answered that one. Essentially,
I don't think it's too
already.
Veiled.
But yeah, with this relief for working Americans, from the pump to the grocery store, you're paying more. Nice slogan. I think it's catchy, certainly. Congress needs to act. Obviously, a lot of people are going to say, turn around to you running as a Democrat, despite your sort of slightly, well, not necessarily in the mainstream of the Democratic Party in terms of staying nice and in line behind one person in the leadership, and say, well, hang on, it's your party, it's your president, and it's your houses of Congress right now, especially on things like budgetary issues, which only have to go through the House, which is much more secure at present for the Democrats. How would you convince those voters who turn around and see that, again, little D in a pair of parentheses next to your name and say, well, hang on, aren't you the guys who are meant to be sorting it out already?
Well, I guess that goes back to policy over politics, and we have to figure out what we're doing and what we want America to go to. So let's look at like something like the CHIPS Act. We need to onshore our supply chain and our semiconductors. There's no question about that. It cannot be centralized. And even for you guys over in the UK, it can't be centralized in Taiwan or Japan. It can't, right? Because when it is, and there is a point of failure, and one single point of failure, it ripples through everybody's economies. It has to come onshore. And so if we all agree that's a thing that we need to do for not only our businesses, but national security, then passing the CHIPS Act was very important to make sure that the Intel plant over here in outside of Columbus, Ohio, is getting built and bringing those jobs and then going to employ people there for hopefully decades or generations. And all those auxiliary businesses that are going to be built up around it. That was an important legislation to pass. If we all agree, red or blue, RD, that's something we need to do. When it comes to different policies as well. So I think what you're really asking is, how do we create consensus among the populace of what is important for America right now? And the only way we could do that is to talk to each other, right? And figure out where the goals align. And so when somebody says, I am paying more at the pump, or my food is too high, or my food prices are too high at the moment, we have to think about, how do we protect that in the future? And what do we put in place in policy-wise to protect that in the future? Pump too high, energy independence. Again, if we're relying on Saudi oil or OPEC or whatever, or a war breaking out in Europe, and that will affect our gas prices, or if we have a down, or if the oil companies or the gas companies have a down couple of years because of a pandemic, and now they have to recoup their money because, or their earnings for their shareholders, and that's going to be gouging people at the pump. We have to figure out alternatives. And what does that look like? I don't know the answers of what that actually looks like going forward, but I do know that's a conversation we have to have. And if we can get consensus around what that looks like, then we pass the policy for it.
Certainly an insight into that little particular part of your website. We're going to go down a couple more of those policy lists and see if we can sort of dig behind the very nicely presented website to see what's sort of underneath in terms of things like a statement you say, making a living wage for all Americans, or a livable wage, not being paid a wage of starvation, as you put it on your campaign site, but a living wage. Now, you've admitted on there that it'll be different for plenty of local areas. You might not necessarily expect a living wage in sort of rural Wyoming to be the same as, again, maybe to Los Angeles or New York, something like that, as we all appreciate costs and prices being slightly different. But from a federal level, which is where you would be acting in Congress should you win this election, is there something to be said for maybe a minimum universal level that no state or city can go below? Or would you just think that's too much to intervene? You'd have people making a mockery of the system. How would you seek to get this livable wage?
Well, I think that we have to think about this in multifaceted. First, you're implying a federal minimum wage, and raising that federal minimum wage of, from what it is, $7.25 an hour right now to a certain amount. And I think that you alluded to it earlier, that Wyoming, Los Angeles, New York, Ohio, they have different standards of cost of living. And I have been always for I don't think that the federal government should really mandate a lot of these kind of economic issues to the states for the regional purposes, but almost more give them guidelines of how to operate, right? And so, for example, if Ohio's 7th district and how it's drawn, and I think that maybe these guidelines could actually make our districts in these gerrymandering issues a little bit more fair. If we tied their these guidelines to what the districts look like. For example, if we wanted a standard minimum wage for Ohio's 7th district, you know, match that to CPI and then adjusted for inflation over, you know, going forward, what would that look like? You know, and what's in that bucket for your CPI? We're talking about rent and you know, your cell phone bill, insurance, and so on and so forth. What does that look like? Is that a $12 an hour? Is that a $8 an hour? Is that a $20 an hour? We actually don't know. And I can tell you right now, if we figure that out for Ohio's 7th, California's 47th is going to be different, right? And so I think that a federal guideline of what is in that bucket and have the states try to work that out of how to take that bucket and apply it to these different districts or regions, I think will be a better thing than saying, hey, everybody's $15 an hour. Again, because, you know, the different regions have different costs of living and so on and so forth. Also different policies, state policies, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on that point, there will be many people who will hear that and say, that sounds fine, but maybe they don't have a particularly favorable political opinion of different leaders across the United States. So they would assume that leaders in some states would be trying to undercut that minimum wage to just boost the economy and forget the living wage type that we're trying to put in, or that this policy is trying to put in here. And others would say, well, no, actually, some other states will price out working businesses just by trying to put in a livable wage, or what they claim to be the livable wage. How would you seek to address that, which we would probably see as some form of wage inequality to a greater or lesser extent across America based on these political decisions? From, again, you would be doing this from a federal standpoint rather than from a state standpoint if you're elected to this position.
So I think what you're saying is how are the politicians in other states going to either screw over businesses or screw over workers?
Well, I think that's certainly something that people will say is likely to happen, because there's a lot of polarization right now in America, as I think you'll agree.
So the answer to that question always is going to be to vote. These are elected officials that you put into power or put into a place of representation. You vote their asses out of office if they're screwing over your businesses or screwing over your workers. There's no other choice to that. Every policy you put in place, you can say, hey, slippery slope. What if they screw us over? Yes. What if they screw us over? Do we think that $7.25 an hour right now is the ultimate minimum wage, or we should get rid of the minimum wage? We can have that discussion as well. And then have the market figure it out. That's not what I'm saying here. Is I'm saying that what we need to do is create a standard for states to implement from region to region, state to state, and they can implement it. Now, the only thing that we can say there is it's up to the people. The people have the power to vote people in, that people vote people out, that have their interest in mind. And it's a business interest, a social interest, a personal interest, a worker interest, a union interest. And so, yeah, we can slippery slope all day. At the end of the day, it's up to the vote and going to the polls.
So I think turnout's going to be... Actually, where would you say turnout's going to be in this election? Because you've been on the ground, you've been knocking on doors. Are people energized to vote this time around, or is it a bit sort of, oh, not again?
You know, I feel that there people are energized, but then here's the thing: is when you're working in, when you're doing what I'm doing, you put yourself into a bubble, an artificial bubble, a bubble of people who's always talking about policy, a bubble that's always people that's talking about getting to be able to the vote polls, a bubble of people that's always knocking doors, a bubble of people that knows the ins and outs of all the political rigmarole. And I think that by being in that bubble, and this is the bubble that people talk about all the time, is when you become a politician, you become you don't relate to what's happening on the ground sometimes. And so during a campaign, I don't think we're the best person to ask if there's any enthusiasm, because we're all enthusiastic in one way or the other.
That's actually a really useful insight, because again, I did a little bit of background research on you, and I think this is the first time you've stepped into that bubble in terms of running for a position like this, for certainly for federal level, as far as I could see. I'm not sure whether that thing maybe slightly lower down on a state level that I might have missed. Apologies if I did.
No, you're right. But, good research.
How has it been making that transition from phew? How has it been making that transition from sort of ordinary day-to-day life and doing your 9-to-5 or whichever jobs that you'd be going to, and then suddenly everything is about how can I represent people of Ohio 7th and how can I get into Congress to do it?
That's an interesting question. I actually don't know how to answer that. I think that home life has changed. You know, personal life has absolutely changed. I honestly don't know how to answer that. Any transition in life is a transition, right? And you have to, and there's good, bads, and you have to weather it. So like, this is no different than, you know, graduating high school and going to college, you know, or graduating college and going to work. You know, there's pain points and there's good points, right? And you weather it. You put your shoes on, you keep marching forward, you know? So I think that's the way I look at it. This is not any kind of transition. And so if we transition from, you know, a congressional candidate to a congressman, I'm going to have that transition as well. And if I transition from a congressional candidate to a failed congressional candidate, I'm going to have that transition as well. So it's no different than any transition I think that you have in life.
I think it's always useful to get that sort of insight of when people, that everyone talks about the bubble, whether it's the Westminster bubble in the UK, the Washington bubble, sort of Beltway bubble as well. It's always interesting to sort of peek behind the veil and see how it's all going. You seem to be adapting to it quite nicely. You're out there producing some good campaign videos, knocking on doors, getting the message to go to the polls. Slightly less cringy than Hillary Clinton with her Pokemon Go reference back in 2016 as well. I did want to mention one thing specifically, and this was something put forward, I believe, by Senator Tammy Baldwin. It's the Dairy Pride Act, which is mentioned specifically on your campaign website. And I'll just read it. I'll read some of it. I won't read the whole bill. That would take a bit of a while. But it's defending against imitations and replacements of yogurt, milk and cheese to promote regular intake of dairy every day, or that act, to protect the integrity of dairy products by enforcing existing labeling requirements. So in a phrase, essentially, it's making sure that if it comes from an animal, it can be labeled milk, yogurt or cheese. But if it's not from that, so nuts, seeds, plants, algae, it would no longer be able to be called milk, yogurt or cheese or other dairy related terms. And please feel free to correct me if I mischaracterize the policy. We've got here a push for a push against this nutritional equivalency, which is labeled in the act as inaccurate. This shift from what is in the dairy food group to what is not in the dairy food group. And I wonder, there's been a lot of change recently as to what we're seeing on our high street shelves in our stores and in our supermarkets, as to now there are so many different varieties of milk. And one thing that may well be doing is, as you say on your website, potentially harming the dairy farmers in your district and in America. But what it might also be doing is providing that real alternative for making that change to potentially a more environmentally friendly option, but without having to say, no, I'm having oats, whatever the replacement term would be, whilst keeping it nice and familiar. How do you feel about sort of squaring a circle that may or may not be being drawn by everyone, but is being drawn by some?
I think that first of all, Wayne County is a massive dairy producer, and that's my district. But here's what I think that the question we should be asking. How much leeway do we continue to give the laboring and the marketing industry at the expense of our either health, our pocketbook, or our understanding of food? For example, like, how long have we had, I don't know if you guys have it in the UK, but here we have something called natural and artificial flavors. What the hell does that even mean, natural flavors, right? And so if somebody says naturally flavored or natural flavors or natural whatever, it's on the box, it's marketed, right? And so we think that instinctually, you think that I'm getting something natural. Nature is good for me. I'm eating something good. I'm waiting for somebody to take that off the box. Let's say, hey, this is bullshit. This is not natural. Or, you know what I'm saying? Or some of the ingredients that we have in there. Or just understanding of like how to eat in health and our intake of protein to fiber to carbs and what have you. And so, look, I think that the willy-nilly use of the word milk is one of those things that we have to go like, is this milk? Is it milk? What is milk? Milk is something that is produced by a mammal, right? and it's not produced by an almond. I've never had almond. Like, what is that? You know? And so I think we just have to be honest with ourselves. And in marketing, it can get carried away with, you know, making us think that something is a way to make us feel better about consuming it. So there's a lot of like marketing practices. Here's another one that irritates me. I see up to a lot, up to 100% effective. What does up to 100% effective mean? That is an absolute, like, first of all, you have 100% on there. That's the natural thing you're going to gravitate to. And but it says up to in front of it. That is absolutely you're being bamboozled with this. So not just talking about this specific act. I think we have to talk about marketing and labeling that is purposely dubious to the consumer to make them be tricked into something's efficacy, something's product category, something's nutritional benefits, and so on and so forth, so that consumers can make better and more educated choices. If you're making a product that is crap and it's crap for the person, or it's crap, like let's make sure it's labeled properly, or you can make better products, right? And if it isn't this certain product, then you can make that product better. And you know, it's all about marketing. It's about making a good thing. So if almond milk is actually better for you, we don't have to call. We can say this almond, whatever you want to put it there, the marketers will figure it out. But I really understand that, you know, somebody who has a dairy farm or you know, with cows or goats or whatever, is kind of going like, this isn't milk, man. My family's been doing this for generations. This is milk. This is cheese. This is butter. You know, and it's kind of like I think we're gonna see that slippery slope as well when it comes to like the Beyond Burgers and Impossible Burgers as well. Like, if what would they call it if it said Impossible Meat, it's Beyond Burger. You know, so it's like, let's understand what this is first, and people need to have that education without the marketing just kind of like putting a veil over it.
I think it's certainly something that we're going to see more and more as these products continue to become more and more sort of mainstream on our shelves. So it's good to have an insight into one of the various opinions around that particular issue. So thank you for that. Coming towards the end of the time that we've got together, but I just wanted to talk about the race itself. So obviously you're up against Max Miller, former Trump aide, and all that comes with that, which I'm sure is well, actually, I was going to say it might be not playing too well on the doorstep, but given that Ohio's 7th went, I think, 66% to Donald Trump back in 2020, perhaps it's an uphill battle, and certainly that's what 538 aggregates your chances of winning at. Unfortunately, they've put you at 2% chance of a victory in this race. And when the last time a Democrat's won Ohio's 7th is 1936, it's got to be a little bit demoralizing sometimes. So there's got to be something about you. What makes you believe you can break that 86-year drought?
Well, first, let's take this back. Ohio's 7th has already been changed and it's been redistricted. So when for the past decade, it was represented by representatives that were in a plus R18 district, right? So means it's 18% leaning Republican. To break that kind of barrier is hard. Now we're in now with redistricting and all, an R plus seven. There has been many races and important races around the country that has flipped R plus seven districts, right? And with the baggage of my opponent, personal and professional, we feel that this is a very winnable and doable race, right? Because of all that baggage. Now, look, we're not saying that this is an easy lift. It has the connections. He's a rich kid himself, you know, come from legacy money to one of the most powerful families in the history of Cleveland. Plus, he worked for the ex-president of the United States, who just happened to be a billionaire himself. So the money differential is, and he's married to one of the richest people in Northeast Ohio as well. So like the money differential is something that we can't take out of the equation. Like, he has a funny advantage, but I always tell people, like, look, we have this race. It is what it's going to be, but now we have to look at the fundamentals of the race, the fundamentals of the candidates, their backgrounds, their histories. And then I really honestly believe that, presented with the proper facts, the electorate will make the best choice. And so that's what's given us hope, is knowing that we are running a good race. I have a diverse and rich background that can take to Washington and bring a lot of, I think, very good clarity to policy. as well as don't come with all the baggage that he does. So that's what's giving us hope, being hopeful for this.
I think being hopeful is something that I think every candidate wants to take into election day, certainly. And again, you all start on zero votes. No one starts with a majority in a brand new election. So there we go. There's some things to look forward to and think, well, you know, election day is just around the corner. And I'll be up all night. I'll be keeping a close eye out and seeing what happens in Ohio's 7th congressional district.
Oh, awesome, man. Send me a text when you find out the news.
Oh, absolutely. Don't worry. I'll be live on air.
Oh, cool, man.
We've got a couple of pop questions to end this particular one with. And it's a little bit of fun. It's a little bit more relaxed. You can take it. There's not going to be a massive scrutiny of policy or of choice here. We'll start with, who's your favorite Democrat right now? You're running for the Democratic Party. There's got to be, you can pick a group of people if you want, but out of anyone who's sort of either at state level or national level, who is it you're looking at and thinking, yeah, that's why I'm a member of this party right now?
Barack Obama.
Fair enough. That's a nice, straightforward, right down the nose.
Yeah. I mean, look, that guy came back on the campaign trail the past couple of weeks, and you understood why he was the president of the United States. You understood why he, gave so many people hope. You understood why he was. You understand the skills that he had, the temperament he had, the way of speaking. Yeah, Barack Obama.
I rather feel that sort of means that my question of your favorite president in American history may well go the same way. Yes, no? Is it a different person?
No, it's probably the same person. Yeah, you know, and I don't want to. Let's take this back. Chipping away at policies. You know, we can go back to Kennedy. We could also, you know, Eisenhower. We can go to, you know, Obama. You know, the policies and individual policies within an administration can be scrutinized, you know, in a lot of different ways. So let's take that out really quick when it comes to the policy. The person, right? The way that he presented himself, the way that he represented America, you know, abroad, the way that you would feel proud of who he was when you went abroad or different places and said, yeah, I'm American and Barack Obama is my president. And when he got on TV, you were happy when he got on TV and you were like, that is my president of the United States. So I would use that criteria of how he made the nation look, how he presented the nation, how he spoke about the different issues here in a calm yet nuanced manner. And I think he would be my favorite.
And I mean, we've talked about working across the aisle quite a bit in this interview. So for a last question, your favorite Republican at state level, national level, but they've got to still be doing something right now. You can't go back and pick Lincoln. That's too easy. That's a catch-all answer. Anyone who's at state level, as I say, national level, who's your favorite? Who would you most like to sit down and work something over with?
Huh, right now.
Oh, yeah. Asking all the tough questions at the very last moment so you can't run.
No, this is a good one. You know, I never really thought of I never think of like favorites when it comes to these things, because policy is so nuanced that everybody brings something to the table. So it's like, even if I say Barack Obama or, you know, a Democrat, it's still like, what's the nuance of policy and how they discuss it? And that's very important. I would say that there's two people that are in politics right now. One is the outgoing congressman here from Ohio's 16th district, Anthony Gonzalez. He has a very interesting background. He was a two-term congressperson that retired after he voted to impeach Donald Trump. His votes as of late have been very reflective, I think, of his true politics. And I think a divergence of, I think, party politics that he tried to get himself into, and I think he felt uncomfortable with. And so I'd really wanted to, you know, sit down and talk to him about that journey and see where he landed on the state of affairs within our democracy of party politics and policymaking. I think that the other person would probably be Dan Crenshaw from Texas. I think that he is when he first came on the scene, he was a very thoughtful, nuanced individual. He did turn into the WWE style politician that's, you know, trying to get clicks and so on and so forth. And I think that he went a little bit off the rails. They call him Cringe Shaw, right? So I don't know what made him take that turn, but him, I think at the core of who he is that made him jump into politics and to run for Congress is somebody I would like to sit down with and you know, just hash out some different policies, or, you know, just talk about his journey and where he feels that he and the country should go. So I think those are my two.
Very, very well fielded on the tricky minefield of those last three questions. But that is, I believe, our time come to an end. I know you've got a very busy, or I'd imagine you've got a very busy day, couple of days left in you of either standing outside polling stations or getting yourself knocking on doors in those last few hours today. So I'll let you go. And thank you very much for your time appearing on the Politics Unboxed podcast.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me. It was a lot of fun. Good to meet you.
So that was the interview from Politics Unboxed with Matthew Deamer, candidate for United States Congress, the House of Representatives, for Ohio's 7th District. Thank you again to Matthew for appearing on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, then you know where to find other great content from the Politics Unboxed family by going to www.politicsunboxedpodcast.wordpress.com or on Instagram at politics.unboxed. You can find us on Twitter at politicsu, or you can find us on Facebook by searching for Politics Unboxed. Thank you for listening, and we will see you around for the next episode very soon.